Otherwise, we'd be here until midnight, and who knows what the weather would be doing by then. So mainly, I'm going to focus on the last 10 verses that Mary just read, verses 38 to 48. Hopefully, though, you won't feel shortchanged, because I could have preached for hours longer, even on those 10 verses. So you're going to get your money's worth tonight, don't worry, because there's so much in those verses. I think that these passages, the passage that Mary's just read to us, is what lies behind what we call the Great Commission, which is Matthew 28, 16 to 20, which is the sending out of the disciples. So seen that way, that passage that we've just heard is where the entirety of the Gospel of Matthew is going. But even more than that, I think it's where Jesus is going and where we as Christian disciples need to go as we live our lives. This is the end goal of the meaning of the word Emmanuel, which you'll all know from Christmas, which is the goal of the discipleship, and that our goal is to bring God with us to the world. So let's listen to verse 38 to 48 one more time. 38 to 43, excuse me. It feels long. Not that Mary didn't read it really well, but I think they're powerful enough that we should probably listen to these particular verses and contemplate them. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to them with the other cheek also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take your shirt, hand over your coat as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, then go with them 2 miles. Give to the one who asks you, and do not turn away from the one who wants to borrow from you. You've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you might all be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and on the good, and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Are not even the tax collectors doing that? And if you greet only your own people, what are you doing more than the others? Don't even pagans do that? Be perfect, therefore, as your heavenly Father is perfect. Now, these are some of the most challenging words in the whole of the Gospels, in fact, probably in the whole of the Bible. The injunction to love your enemies will not sit well with most of us. And I want to most openly admit to you that I struggle with this very strongly. And I'm not going to go around and ask people to admit whether they struggle with it as well, but I would be surprised if other people here don't struggle with it. So let's take a breath and look for a second on the instruction that Christ was contrasting his words with to understand better what's being asked of us. So that's something that was called the lax talionis, or the law of retribution, of retaliation, the eye for an eye. It was an attempt, to enact fair justice among the people of ancient Israel. Whatever harm is committed, whatever intentional, and in Leviticus we talk about this, or not, and we talk about that in Exodus, the judges of ancient Israel were expected to authorize the law of retaliation, an eye for an eye. It's not to be practiced only in cases when an evil person causes injury, rather it's a law that expresses a commitment to justice, and it ensures that the penalty is not arbitrarily making the punishment more severe than the crime. So that all sounds fair and just, and quite a lot of us would think, yeah, well, we can see the logic of that. But Jesus, in these verses which we just heard, admonishes his followers not to oppose the evildoer violently. The word in Greek is asteznai. I always mispronounce my Greek. The translation we heard today from the New Revised Standard Version says do not resist an evildoer. And that's not quite right, and implies no opposition to oppose. We should hear that rather Jesus had an alternative strategy for dealing with evil. His objective is actively to overcome evil with good, as some notable people from history sought to enact those words understand. We'll talk about that later. But first of all, you must determine just who your enemies are. Who are we being asked to love? It's comparatively easy to think of people whose behavior is particularly egregious on the world stage and call them our enemies. In times of war, we're particularly clear in knowing who our enemies are. Obviously, during the Second World War, it was the Nazis. Now we might feel that the Russians, because of their behaviour in Ukraine, are our enemies. But, or we might want to say that the Russians' behaviour is not great, but we might not want to use the word enemies. And personally, we might be able to think of some people who have acted in a less than perfect way towards us. Is that enough to call those people our enemies? Is that the word we would use? Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a very famous German theologian who opposed Hitler very strikingly and who died in as a consequence, gets right to the heart of this text. He writes, "By our enemies, Jesus means those who are quite intractable and utterly unresponsive to our love. But love asks nothing in return, but seeks those who need it. And who needs our love more than those who are consumed with hatred and utterly devoid of love? The love of our enemies takes us along the way to the cross and into the fellowship of the crucified." The ultimate sanction appealed to here is not the will of God, but to God's nature. It's not saying, do it no matter how difficult because God commands it, but rather this passage is revealing to us the nature of God. Another great source in understanding how this level of forgiveness works is to understand its call to renounce our rights, something we normally like to arm ourselves with. Another writer on the topic of this passage says, "The world says that it is your legitimate right, your dignity, and your duty to bring suit against the one who has injured you, to press her until she has redressed the wrong, to accuse her, to punish her, until her hurt is at least equal to yours. This is just. This re-establishes the order that her sin destroyed. This places the burden of reconciliation totally and righteously upon the one who started the mess. And this is not forgiveness. As scandalous as it seems to the world, forgiveness places the burden of reconciliation upon the one who suffered the mess." So one of the complexities with dealing with this whole passage is the temptation to interpret these injunctions as dated, because we don't really want to live by this. So we're always looking for what's the excuse that allows us not to live by it. So we can call it dated. We can say that's something that belongs in Jesus's time, but maybe not in ours. We might be tempted to say that these are Bible verses that cannot stand the test of time, because the distance between Jesus' world and our world is too broad, the expanse is too broad for us to traverse. We might want to say that Jesus' world was simpler than ours, that Jesus' context did not have any of the complexities of our own reality and our own global politics. Until we remember that Jesus lived and did his ministry in a Palestine that was a Roman province. Until we recall that the Gospels were written in a post-temple, post-Jerusalem, post-destruction reality, then suddenly Jesus' world doesn't seem that far from our own. As we realize that the heart of Jesus' message in Matthew is a message essential for what it means to be the church today. And there are other temptations here if we're still looking for a way to dodge these verses and the implications of these verses. There's a temptation not to take them too seriously, to assume that Jesus didn't really expect us to do these things, only to remind of us of our inability to satisfy God's commands, so that we might flee to Jesus for forgiveness and grace. So we shouldn't even bother trying to do all that hard stuff, but just immediately trust in Jesus's forgiveness. But what if Jesus was serious? Now, if we take these words seriously, we're building towards the climax in verse 48. The seemingly even more outrageous words that we ended with tonight. "Be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect." I'll come back to that. Don't worry, we'll do that one at the end. The second temptation will be to take them too seriously, as in believing that we've got it in us, all of us, to do all of this. Now, there was a 4th century monk called Pelagius who became one of the most famous heretics of his time. And Pelagius believed that we could all overcome sin in ourselves and in the world and do all that is necessary. Seen this way, it's heretical to think that we are sufficient. Following this logic, we do not need God's grace, only God's instruction and encouragement. But, as I say, that was a heresy, and I'm sure we would all want to reject that heresy. So how do we deal with these difficult words? not minimizing them, not disregarding them or seeing them as on their own as the key to salvation, but accepting their challenge and letting that challenge change us through our relationship with the living God. Then there's another issue. That true forgiveness, loving our enemies, can be seen as not just an unrealistic standard, but one that I might not be convinced is right if we think of people from history or even from our own lives who have harmed us, who have acted terribly. We might struggle with the idea that we should hold them to account. We shouldn't hold them to account. If we think badly enough of them, when we're not that we're willing to use the word enemy about them, then some of us struggle that it's the right, and I'll put inverted commas over that, thing to do, to forgive them. I know that's where I personally get caught. Some of you might have heard me talk in another sermon about my experiences with my father, for example, and you'll understand why this is hard for me. Sometimes it's hard to forgive people. Sometimes it's hard to even believe that it's right to forgive them. And certainly people throughout history have opposed Christianity, have used this against us. Karl Marx said, "The social principles of Christianity preach cowardice, self-contempt, abasement, submissiveness, and humbleness." And it's only Karl Marx who could use the word humbleness there as an insult word. But before dismissing these critiques too quickly, we should perhaps point out that indeed, turning the other cheek and returning hatred with love is no way to get ahead in this world. For the rules of this kingdom are well known. In our normal life, it's a dog-eat-dog world, where only the strong survive. But that's just the point. Jesus isn't trying to modify the rules of this world. He's not, contrary to what the American Christians call the prosperity preachers, inviting you to figure out how to make the most of this world or have your best life now. And Christ is not inviting you to find a safe port among the storms of this world. Rather, he's starting a revolution by calling the rules of this world into question and at the very same time, redeeming this world that he loves and that he will, in due time, that put him to death. Jesus calls the powers of the day into question by describing an entirely different way to relate to each other, inviting us into relationships governed not by power, but by vulnerability, grounded in love. An eye for an eye makes all the world blind, Gandhi would say some 2,000 years later. Here Jesus invites us to overcome the urge for retribution with loving submission and forbearance. Yet he isn't satisfied with merely overturning this world, for the very essence of his critique, that we are created not merely for justice, but also for love and for life, is simultaneously the only possible hope for those embellished in the orders of the world. Strength eventually falls, power corrupts, and survival of the fittest leaves so many bodies on the ground. Love alone transforms, redeems, and creates new life. As Martin Luther King Jr. once said, "Darkness cannot drive out darkness, only light can do that. Hate cannot drive out hate, only love can do that." So let's take a moment to reflect on what we've heard so far by singing our next hymn. Now, so, keeping on with our thoughts, but I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to make the what we heard tonight from the Bible any easier, but I'll try and find a way for us to understand it better. And it might be helpful to know that at the time of Jesus, love and hate were not to be understood in terms of internal emotional states, feelings, or attitudes. Jesus is not asking us to feel the love towards our enemies. He's not a 60s hippie, and I think it's important to remember that. Persons at the time of Jesus had little concern for things psychological. Words referring to an internal state always indicate they're corresponding to external expression as well. For example, to covet always involved an attempt to take what one desired. Hence, the best word to translate that is to steal. So it's not about what your thoughts are, it's about what you're doing. Therefore, so to love our enemies doesn't mean to try to feel affection for them. It's not that impossible. The Greek language comes to our aid when we're trying to seek to analyze the meaning of the love with special reference to our enemies. There are three words in the Greek language for love. There's actually more, but there's three we'll focus on tonight. There is a word, eros, for example. Eros refers to a sort of, we would understand that in the term that we quite frequently use love. And Plato uses it a great deal in his dialogue. It's a yearning of the soul for the realms of the divine. But it's also romantic love. We would call it a romantic love. It's eros that we think about on Valentine's Day, if that helps. If you imagine Valentine's cards, they've all got eros written on them. And so that we kind of know about that love, most of us. We've normally experienced it, and we've read about it in all the beauties of literature, and some very bad literature as well. So it's something we feel quite confident about. And there's a quote here, love is not love which alters when its alteration finds or bends with its remover to remove. It's an ever-fixed mark that looks on the tempest and is never shaken. It is a star to every wandering bark. Shakespeare? Yeah? I'm not going to ask you to spot it, but it's Shakespeare. Now, that's beautiful. It's a beautiful way to talk about love, but it's eros that that's talking about. The Greek language also talks about philioi, which is another level of love. It's a sort of intimate affection between personal friends. In fact, we would call it friendship. And so on this level, you love because you are loved. It's a reciprocal love. You love the people that you like. Then the Greek language has another word. It's called agape. Agape is much more than a romantic love. Agape is much more than even friendship. Agape is understanding the redemptive goodwill for all. Agape is an overflowing love, a spontaneous love, which seeks nothing in return. And theologians would say it's the love of God operating in the human heart. When you rise to this love on this level, you love all, not because you like them, not because their ways appeal to you, not because they are worthwhile to you, but because you love them, because God loves all. As you rise to the noble heights of loving the person who does the evil deed while hating the deed that person does, that's agape. And I think this is what Jesus means when he says, love your enemies, as I say. And I'm so happy he didn't say, like your enemies, because I can tell you now I won't be able to do that. That feels too difficult for me. Like is sentimental. Like is an affectionate sort of thing. We can't like, for example, all the Russians who are committing atrocities in Ukraine. And we might all have personal stories of people in our own lives that we find difficult to like. But Jesus says, love them. And love is greater than like. Love is understanding, redemptive, creative, goodwill for all. And so Jesus was expressing something very creative when he said, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, pray for them that despitefully use you. As Jesus points out, God treats God's enemies, the evil and the unrighteous, the same as God's friends, the good and the righteous. Ought we not to do the same? And if we are kind only to those who we're close to, aren't we simply repeating those we hate do also? And as it says in the Bible verse we heard tonight, where's the merit of that? There is no path to love. Love is a path. I like the way that Eugene Peterson, who did the work on the Message, the translation, the Message, which we don't often read in this church, and I'm not 100% confident when we ever read it, because it's not really a translation. It's, I suppose, a transliteration. It's not that he's looking back at the original Hebrew and Greek and finding the right words, but he's trying to sum up the meaning of those words in his translation. So the Message isn't, as I say, it's a creative way of looking at the translation of the Bible. And so listening to one of the verses we heard tonight, he says, in a word, what I'm saying is, grow up. You're kingdom subjects. Now live like it. Live out your God-created identity. Live generously and graciously towards others the way that God lives towards you. So that's the verse that I said we'd return to later. And again, I'm going to say we'll come back to it later again. But I think it's a powerful verse, especially when you hear the Message way of trying to put it in simpler terms. So let's try and look at some examples, because I think that might help us, where people have been able to rise above their human natures, if you like, and find the strength needed to counteract those people, the doubters of someone like Marx. It may also help me with my own worries that I won't be able to manage it. I've mentioned Martin Luther King earlier when I used a quote by him, and I find him particularly inspirational when we worry we're being called to be some kind of holy pushover in the face of evil. And in fact, all of each of us, these behaviors, we're called to exhibit great strength and in turn build strength and resilience within all of us. If you've not read any of Martin Luther King's words lately, I think you might find it inspiring to read some of them, his teachings on nonviolence. In particular, I'm going to quote from one speech that he delivered to the YMCA and the YWCA at the University of California, and that was in 1957. And he said, when speaking about the need to teach about nonviolence, "We had to make it clear that nonviolent resistance is not a method of cowardice. It does resist. It is not a method of stagnant passivity." That's a wonderful phrase. "And a deadening complacency. The nonviolent resistor is just as opposed to evil that he's standing against as the violent resistor. But he resists without violence. This method is non-aggression, not aggressive physically, but strongly aggressive spiritually." And then a little later in the same speech, he said, and I wish I had Martin Luther King's voice when I was saying this, because I'm sure it would sound 100 times more powerful. "Another thing that we've had to get over was the fact that the non-violent resistor doesn't seek to humiliate or defeat the opponent, but to win his friendship and his understanding. That the aftermath of nonviolence is reconciliation and the creation of a beloved community. It merely means to awaken a sense of shame within the oppressor, but the end of this is reconciliation. The end is redemption." It does seem to me that it must take a great deal of strength to turn the other cheek for the sake of the ultimate redemption of the person who's doing the striking than to strike back. So I can see this then as a sign of strength, as a way of strength, not of weakness. However, we have to take on board that if we do all the things God's way, King was clear that we might end up crucified. If we think about the way that Martin Luther King Jr. ended his own life, we can see that. It's a real call, it's a real challenge, and maybe that's another reason why we all struggle with the verses, to take the verses that we heard tonight really seriously. So we're going to take another few minutes listening to another inspirational figure. Now you might remember, and this one I did remember, even though there are so many terrible shootings in America, but I did always remember this one. In 2006, there was a shooting in the West Nickel Mine School. It was an Amish one-room schoolhouse in the Old Order Amish community of Nickel Mines in Pennsylvania. The gunman who did that terrible thing was called Charles Carroll Roberts, and he took hostages and shot 10 girls, aged between 6 and 13, killing 5, but then he committed suicide himself in the schoolhouse. Now, Charles Roberts' mother, who's called Terry Roberts, is a devout Christian, and she spent years since trying to understand what her son did and trying to come to terms with it in some way. And she was greatly helped in this act of forgiveness, by the Amish community themselves. And we're going to see a short clip from a talk that Terry Roberts gave about 8 years ago about her experience of forgiveness at her son's funeral.
Going to the funeral, five days later, I never even thought about going to the girls' funerals. That didn't even enter my mind. I was in so much grief. And yet, as we went to the gravesite for our son, 30 to 40 Amish come and surround the gravesite as a prayer covering around us, shielding us from the cameras that were out on the road. Wow, what a blessing that was to our hearts. But who greeted us? The first parents to greet us were the parents that lost not just one daughter at the hand of our son, but lost 2 daughters at the hand of our son. Wow. Who here has anything in their heart they cannot forgive or they choose not to forgive. Forgiveness is a choice that we make. It's not a feeling, and it's not an emotion. It is a choice that we make. But once that choice is made, the feelings and the emotions will follow. And as for the Amish, they say we need to forgive every day. But they follow what the directions of, you know, that Jesus gave us. Forgive and you will be forgiven. Forgiveness is not an easy choice.
So can we learn from these inspirational people? And can we all learn to turn the other cheek, to love our enemies, and to pray for those who persecute us? Honestly, probably no, not perfectly. On some days, maybe not at all. But that's not really the point. It's not our job to bring in the kingdom. Jesus does that. It's our job to live like we really believe Jesus is actually bringing in God's kingdom, and to realize that we get practice living like Jesus' disciples and citizens of his new kingdom in the meantime. We hear the idea of loving our neighbors in many places in the Gospels. Love your neighbor is in chapter 5, 43, is central to Jesus' teaching, and we'll repeat it on two other occasions in Matthew. In both these instances, the phrase is central to what Jesus thinks about the entire law of God. He says to one inquiring lawyer, "Of these two commandments, love God and love the neighbor, hang all the law and the prophets." However, here in chapter 5, Jesus is extending this love even further, this law further towards the enemy. Of course, we've all been reflecting on people we cannot so easily love, those that do us harm and shame them. This counterintuitive act requires prayer to help us to love, to pray for our enemies. We're being told to pray for our enemies. Such a practice beforehand will become a person's right action in life. In the Lord's Prayer, this idea is constant with the theme of forgiveness. Forgiving others who have wronged you is crucial to receiving God's forgiveness as well. Just as God provides good things, the rain for the just and the unjust, so must God's followers treat others, whether good or evil, with consistent love. Care for the other, despite the other's actions, sums up the language of perfection, maturity, and fulfillment in life. There's a particularly sharp end of today's passage that can make us feel like we thought we were going to be able to try to do this, and then we're hit with the hardest challenge. This feels like the most ridiculously hard part. Be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect. One key observation here, though, is that's possibly quite helpful, is the word we translate as perfect is the Greek word teleos, and that implies a moral perfection, less of moral perfection than it does about reaching one's intended outcome. The teleos of an arrow shot by an archer is to reach its target. The teleos of a peach tree is to yield peaches. This means that we might not be able to translate this passage more loosely. We can translate this passage more loosely to mean, be the person and the community God created you to be, just as God is the one God that God is supposed to be. So Jesus' words are less a command than a promise. God sees more in you than you do. God has plans and a purpose for you. God intends to use you to achieve something spectacular. And that something spectacular is precisely to be who you were created to be. And so in going to help to create a different kind of world, we are called to do that, to help create that. Jesus calls this new world the kingdom of God, where violence doesn't always breed more violence, and hate doesn't always kindle more hate. This approach doesn't forget or even minimize the presence of sin in us or in the world, but neither does it assume God is limited by our own sin. Rather, it takes seriously that we are always being called by Jesus to be more than we thought we could be and invited to claim our identity as God's chosen and beloved people as we live in the world. Jesus' message here, returning hate with love, turning the other cheek, praying for those who we stand against us, is incredibly countercultural. If we were politicians, these are not messages that win you elections. But it may help to change this world for a better. Change, not save. That's Jesus' job, to do the saving. It's our job to do the changing for him. And we're free to take the care of the corner we live in, practicing to live like Jesus' disciples throughout the week, and then returning into church each Sunday to be reminded again of Jesus' grace and forgiveness, and to be sent out once more to live as part of Jesus' kingdom. Martin Luther once said that the Christian life is not about arriving, but always about becoming. And St. Augustine said that the Lord's Supper would invite people to receive who you are and then go become what you have received. This Sunday, like all times we hear the word, is a chance to continue to receive the identity God gives us and to become the person that God has created us to be. So we're all invited to consider who we are going to be and to begin to practicing it. Perhaps we could start by simply taking a few minutes now to pray for someone with whom you struggle, someone you might call your enemy, someone you feel has harmed you in some way. It's just a small step, we're going to take a few minutes in silence to allow each one of us to pray for the person we least want to pray for, if we want to put it like that. It's a small step, but one that we may take in grace and in freedom. So let's pray for a few minutes in silence for that person. Ian's now going to lead us in prayers for people in this world and other things that we want to think about. But remember that prayer that you all, and I could feel the power of the prayers in this sanctuary when you were doing them.